This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello. You're with Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. And my name is Mark Wigmore. Thank you for checking in. Welcome to the second episode of the new season, being supported by the New Classical FM and the Zoomer Podcast Network. Very happy to be here. Very happy to be continuing this experiment of a podcast. And so thrilled that people were in touch over the last week and enjoyed what we did. In fact, last week, Montreal musician Alexander Strelitzky was here. It was a very special conversation. And people wrote me to say hello and share their love for Alexandra. And I know she had a listen to it. Her record is Inscape. And if you missed that conversation, you can listen at classicalfm.ca or anywhere you enjoy podcasts. I want to let you know that this episode is sponsored by Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company, very good at what they do, working with award-winning clients, including the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and many others. RedEyeMedia.ca for info on what they do. And Art at the End of the World, also brought to you by Crow's Theater, one of the country's most acclaimed arts organizations and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's Theater creates unforgettable productions that examine and illuminate the pivotal narratives of our times. CrowsTheater.com for info and tickets. So, just saying that right now really does bring us into today's conversation.
In the most powerful state on earth, a group of conspirators have assassinated their populist leader. A civil war erupts as revolutionaries and politicians contend with what they've done and what's to come.
Groundling Theater Company and Crow's Theater present Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Don't miss an exceptional cast of Canada's finest classical actors take on Shakespeare's timeless political masterpiece, Julius Caesar, at Streetcar Crow's Nest. Tickets are on sale now at crowstheater.com.
There's a moment from the radio spot for the new production of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar on stage until this weekend, February 2nd, unless it gets extended. I think there's a strong chance that it will, but at the end of the day, it really does come down to booking and so on and so forth. I went to see this production a couple weeks ago at Streetcar Crow's Nest on Carlaw and Dundas. It's a co-pro between Crow's and Groundling Theatre, two excellent theatre companies, and it is out of this world. Powerful, thoughtful, the acting is incredible, and in the midst of all that's going on in the world, and certainly with Iran and what's happening in the States right now, certainly with a real power struggle there, this very contemporary version of Julius Caesar, I think it hits pretty close to the bone. In fact, any theater or television or film that deals with big power is very compelling at the moment. That's to be sure. But this Julius Caesar, really on target. And my guest today is not only the general and artistic director of Crow's Theater, but also the director of this production. And he managed to get some of the best and brightest from Stratford, the Stratford Festival, and some of the other major theater companies to star in this. And it is just a powerhouse cast. I really haven't stopped thinking about how incredible this piece is. And I've been wanting to get Chris on for a long time, so I'm so thrilled that we've finally had a chance to sit down. What Julius Caesar does so well is that it shows the flaws on either side of a power struggle. You've got Caesar, of course, himself reveling in the moment, clearly out of line in many ways, drunk with power to some degree, and he's pushing towards authoritarian rule, very much a populist set of ideals. He's creating a regime that reflects that. And then we've got these intellectual elites who are conspiring against him. They want to kill him and very misguided in their own way. And the masses are seemingly swayed very easily. So how perfect to put this modernized Julius Caesar on stage right now at this moment. And that's where I'm going to start with Chris today with this particular production. But we go through a lot, his entire career, his thoughts on the power of theater, and just a really thoughtful guy. One thing that he's done with this production is he's created an introduction and an epilogue that gives further context and commentary on this Shakespeare masterpiece. And it creates a very heated conversation based on what they do after the show and maybe even during intermission. I know this because I was witness to these conversations, people getting in heated maybe arguments or debates about what they're experiencing. And I wanted to talk to Chris about the ability to move the political needle in any direction with art, with theater, in 2020. Are we too entrenched in our tribes and our political thinking to be moved by the commentary of artists? Is that where we're at? Just a little more about Chris. He's been the driving force of Crow's Theater since 2008. I've spoken to him numerous times on my different programs. He really watched over the building of their new facility. It is one of the most sought after theaters in the city now. It's like the perfect amount of seating. It can do a lot, very malleable space. For this Shakespeare production, it's in the round. I've seen stadium seating on either side, which has worked very well. So it's a great physical space, but it's also been very welcoming to other theater companies. In fact, Chris is known for collaborating with the Obsidians of the world and Stratford and Groundling, and on it goes. And it's a real feather in his cap. And I mean, I think maybe the biggest risk here was building this facility in Toronto's East End. People sometimes joke, if you know something about Toronto, that Toronto's West End, they call it Friday night, and Toronto's East End is sometimes known as Sunday morning. So that gives you some sort of a picture. So they took a bit of a risk, but they built a wonderful facility, and I think what's happened is the community has really supported it. And it's also helped to change the culture of Toronto's East End. And there are theaters popping up everywhere and restaurants, and just culture is moving to the East End. And I think Crow's has a lot to do with that. Something Chris has done over the years, too, is he's really tried to bring in a young audience. And that might include working with a lot of musicians and pop musicians, the band Stars out of Montreal. He's worked with them numerous times to put on theatrical productions. Members of Billy Talent and Broken Social Scene have put on productions there with Chris. He's the recipient of the John Hirsch and the Ken McDougall Awards, as well the recipient of the 2013 Siminovich Prize, the most prestigious and valuable performing arts prize in Canada. So the man is a talent, and we've had a chance to talk numerous times in a shortened, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes to talk about a particular production, but to get to sit down with him at Crow's Theater in the, I guess it was a green room, sort of deep in the bowels of the Crow's Theater complex. It was just a real treat and very special. And so here is my conversation with the great Chris Abraham on art at the end of the world. I saw Julius Caesar on over the weekend.
Great.
I have questions.
Good.
You know, typically with these things, I would, you know, meander through mm-hmm. your career mm-hmm. and so yep. on and so forth. And we will do that. Mm-hmm. But something struck me about this production, and some people are going to hear this, are going to see it, and mm-hmm. some people aren't. But it doesn't really mm-hmm. matter, because ultimately, you come at this project as a director, mm-hmm. as the artistic director of this mm-hmm. company. With this production, it feels like there's an intention mm-hmm. to start a conversation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have to worry about Shakespeare mm-hmm. and craft and the quality of your actors mm-hmm. and everything. But it also looks to spark a conversation in a very delicate political and cultural moment. Mm-hmm. It is, I admire mm-hmm. that greatly, mm-hmm. to even attempt it. And do you think that it is possible to get to people right now? Are they able to leave their judgments aside and their politics aside and just sort of take this in
and let it stir the pot a little bit? Or are we sort of, has that ship sailed to some degree?
It's a great question. It's what I've been thinking about this morning, actually. We got a review in the Toronto Star this morning, which
I read it.
Yeah, which I found really sad.
Really?
Yeah, I found the review sad. Because it essentially said that, or what I took from it, was there was something about the production that people should be protected from.
Right. I did read that.
You read the same thing.
I read the exact same thing, and I didn't feel the same way. It actually struck me as interesting. I thought, oh gosh, here we are in the era of triggers.
Yeah.
In the era of, oh, be careful, you wouldn't want to... you know, get your feelings hurt or get, you know, you wouldn't want to, you know, there are depictions of violence and so on. And maybe that there's something there.
I mean, it's interesting because it comes up not only with this production, but I've seen it emerge as a kind of critical fashion in the last couple of years. And some of it I understand, but I also think about it in the context of other art forms, popular art forms like Parasite, like, you know, movies and television.
Right.
There's so much violence in general in our culture and in our storytelling. And there's all sorts of reasons for why that is. But I do notice that in the theater, there's a particular sensitivity to violence and depictions of violence in the theater. And I was asking myself this morning, why is that?
The intimacy.
Yeah. I think that that's probably the most straightforward and obvious reason. It's funny because it wasn't something that I thought much about when we were doing the production.
Well, especially when you do Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole focus is politics and violence.
Yes.
That is, and it's been done for centuries.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because my team said, when they saw the show, they said, absolutely, we've got to make sure that we put some warnings on our website so people are prepared for what they're coming into. And I said, well, I mean, it is Julius Caesar, and you know, we do know what happens. And it's a political assassination, and it's a violent political assassination as a starting point. So anyways, that's a great first question because I did have some aims with the production, and they had really not very little to do with violence. They had more to do with emotion and the relationship between emotion and reason in democratic systems, in political discourse, and in general, in, I guess, the human experience and the human psyche. I think that continuum between the mind and the heart is something that Shakespeare's very interested across his entire body of work, and I think it plays out in a really important and timely way in this piece. So that's kind of what I was interested in exploring, how people engage with political language. Do they engage with it with their heads? Do they engage with it with their hearts? How is that working in our world right now?
It's amazing to me how these fundamental stories, these, you know, you look at what he goes after with his various tragedies and comedies, and you could look at them as a template for just about any political or cultural situation that we run into.
Yeah.
It just sort of repeats itself over and over again, and we can go back to Shakespeare and say, well, here was his thinking on this particular thing, almost some sort of a Bible in some sort of way. Now, I will say that given the current climate that we're in, given everything that's going on with Iran and Canada right now, given the intensity of this production, the violence of this production, I did feel a... which is very rare for me. I felt a sense of dread while watching this. And as much as I was exhilarated by the performances and thinking about the words and thinking about the context, it just... very rare, I can honestly say.
And what is that dread?
I guess I just feel closer to these events. So often I'm just being told a tale. It doesn't really affect my life at the end of the day. You know, typically I can walk away from something like that. And even though there are events like that happening in the world, they're not right here.
Yeah.
And for some reason, everything feels a little closer this time.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. That's not really a question.
No, it's interesting, but I'm just super curious about it. If you were to use a different word to describe your feeling other than dread... What is that dread?
Fear.
Fear about what?
Fear about that the world is becoming a little unhinged around me, and that it's as much as I want to believe in the goodness of my community and my country and so on, it is starting to feel like it's coming apart a little. And so, of course, that's what exactly what we're watching.
Well, you know? I do think that that is, in particular the Roman plays, but I do think that that is Julius Caesar.
Right.
The play, while not entirely bleak, is really looks at human nature and the behavior of groups of people in particular through a very dark lens.
You're also putting us there with what you're doing atmospherically, too.
There's
a war. Literally, we can hear the war going on.
Yeah.
Or we can hear the crowds thundering in disapproval or approval behind us. It's quite effective.
I've had this conversation actually with my wife because she's been with me as I've been making this production.
Yeah.
I think we try to retain a fair amount of we have kids. We try to retain some optimism in our household. And and I have felt, as I've been working on the play, a truth in the play that is difficult to look at. I'm compelled by that.
Let's talk about the audience for a moment, because when I walked out of the production, there was this argument happening. It was quite audible. I could hear it. And people were talking about the final 10-15 minutes of the of the show.
Sure.
And some people felt like it was very important and thought it was the best part of the show.
Yeah.
Other people thought that I didn't need that.
Yeah.
I didn't need to be told A, B, and C.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away, but there is sort of a, I guess we would call it an epilogue that you and your team have created to give some more context to this moment. That was the moment where it sort of led to my first question here today, which is, you know, can we affect thinking with art right now? Is it lost? Or are people just going to sort of dig in and say, no, I didn't like that. I didn't like being told about how I should feel politically, about some of the motivations of some of these characters, while others cheer you on.
Yeah. My greatest aspiration in the theater is for people to think their own thoughts and for them to know that whatever I'm doing in the theater is towards that aim. Even if there is a proposition made on stage that they disagree with, my intention is always for people more than just think their own thoughts, but feel their own feelings. I mean, it's funny, like, I think my lesson about this sort of fundamental truth of this relationship between the mind and the heart, or reason and emotion, I really respect that in terms of an audience's experience. I think it's really important for both of those things to be activated in an audience. They have to feel something and they have to think something. And I want an audience to have that dual experience. And whatever they think, whatever they feel, is the goal. I don't need them to think or feel anything in particular. I want them to wake up to their own experience of their inner lives. Because I think we walk around often feeling, I mean, what I'm grateful for when I go to the theater is that experience.
Yeah.
To wake up to what I really think and feel. Not what I feel like I'm supposed to think and feel, but what I think and feel. And that's what I think art does.
Right. So we're typically in this sort of house of media mirrors just beaming at us in a million directions.
You got it.
We ping pong through it.
Yeah.
And here we take this moment to truly say yes or no.
We have quiet and we have focus and we have a group of people, and there is something about being in a room with a bunch of other people and the kind of attention and sense of one's own body and other bodies around you in the theater that I think at its best is provides that experience. So as far as that argument outside the theater, I mean, I don't know. We did a play last year called The Assembly, which was a documentary piece
about
polarization and public discourse.
Right.
And it's part of a whole series that is ongoing that we're now doing around the world that is really about this question of what is going on in the way that we speak to each other, how we listen to each other, how we work things out. And it was another show that met with some resistance in Toronto in particular.
Right.
I just try to observe it. There is a lot. There's a lot going on always, and there is a lot going on in around conversations around how we talk to each other, and what is okay and what isn't okay.
I've checked myself about 20 times so far in this last 20 minutes.
Yeah. It takes me back to the play a little bit, because I think if people are not reacting, are not in a reactive place when they're experiencing a piece of art, but actually really listening to themselves, I do trust that force in artistic communication. You know, even though you felt some dread when mm-hmm. you saw the show.
To me, that's a good thing, because I feel something.
You feel something.
Right.
And you started off by saying that you feel, you made you think about the world, and it made right. you think about the proximity of this play to the world in a different way than you've experienced before, and you right. struggled with that.
Right.
I like that, and I like you sharing that, because it makes me think about how scared people are right now.
Right, right. And maybe that, I think that has something to do with what you read in The Star today, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, it was actually a very good review. Mm-hmm. There was nothing, there was literally not a bad sentence in there as far as, or a sentence that described it as being poorly thought through in any fashion.
No, but I guess it seemed to be warning people against that experience.
And maybe that's just, we're in that moment of warning, warning
maybe.
Each other that you will have emotions.
Yes. yeah.
It's interesting in the framing of it. Even we're playing the radio spot at Classical FM,
yeah.
and it talks about this group of elites who are unhappy with an authoritarian mm-hmm. and populist leader who is mm-hmm. gaining power. They make this decision and are left to deal with the fallout mm-hmm. of this assassination.
Yeah,
pretty obvious to me that you are trying to make some correlations between what's happening in this play and what's happening around us. I think
yep.
it's framed to pique our interest that way.
Of course, yeah.
So in that sense, it does feel down the middle. It's like there's no right or wrong answers here as far as what we're... You're not pointing at any individual political group and saying...
No, no.
Yes, no, right, wrong.
No. But certainly the kind of rise of populist political leaders and populist movements around the world are certainly in our conversation in the piece,
right.
and that's important. But I also feel like that democracy and the principles that underlie democracy, I mean, I really believe in them, but I think that they are under siege in new ways around the world in a way that's really important for us to pay attention to.
Right.
There's a reason why they're meeting with success. With people around the world, and you know, we if we consume news and we consume thinking about that, I think it's important that we pay attention to why that might be going on in the world.
One of the words that gets thrown around, both with Crow's mission and even about this particular production, Julius Caesar, is urgent.
Sure.
There's an urgency.
Yeah.
Who brings that to the table? Is that you bringing that to the table?
Well, I think with Shakespeare in particular, the first question, or with a classic text, with any text that's, I mean, with any play, one of the first questions you learn when you're training to be a director is to ask yourself, why now? Why do it now? Especially with Shakespeare, because there are 500 years of interpretations. And that has to sit alongside what is Shakespeare's main idea that underpins his play. You know, that's what I usually start with, is to try to come to some understanding of what the main idea in a play is, and then fashion my own articulation of that and connect that to why do this now. So maybe the urgency comes from, you know, that question.
Is the urgency, does it go beyond that for you, beyond this production? Do you feel like that is a moniker or a definition that can be just put into the Crow's Theater thinking each and every year? Is there an urgency to everything this?
Well, there's a time, yes and no.
Right.
I think that there are some productions that I pen or direct or am a driving force behind, which speak to that impulse or that desire that I have as an artist. And then there are other calls that I feel as an artistic director that have to do with an audience that we're growing here, and different kinds of experience. If anything, I would say that what I've really tried to do while I've been here is to think about creating really different experiences of liveness for a growing community.
Yeah.
that help us to understand what's possible in the theater in a live context, and how we understand story, each other, and the world we're living in. And that sometimes that the vector of that is tragedy or, you know, challenging material. Sometimes it's laughter.
Right.
Sometimes it's music.
Sometimes it's music. We've seen lots of that. I'll point out, too, yeah, and to your credit, I walked into the intermission of Julius Caesar, and there were young people, there were old people, there were weirdos like me, there were people of color, mm-hmm, there were just people who were, yeah, totally local, people from across town.
Yeah.
That is the greatest, right? That's like the best thing you can really ask for, isn't it?
Yes. The other
not part, every theater can
not
say
every
that.
Theater does that. No, nope. It's true. But the other part that, I mean, I really aspire to is return visits across multiple, very different kinds of experiences.
Right.
Why that's important is because embedded in a season for any artistic director are a series of ideas that are connected, sometimes very consciously and sometimes less consciously. The pleasure is to have an audience that's present through, over time, over a season, over multiple seasons, to be engaged in that conversation through its multiple connection points.
Right. And that would be ideal, and of course.
That's the ideal.
You're listening to Art at the End of the World on the Zoomer Podcast Network. I'm Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Crow's Theater's Chris Abraham continues in a moment. Mark Wigmore with you here on Art at the End of the World. Let's get back to my talk with the thoughtful theater mind from Crow's Theater, Chris Abraham.
The reality in this job is you're always, whatever you're succeeding at, there are 17,000 other things that you're failing at, and you just have to get comfortable with that.
How are you? But that is tough. I mean, did you always see yourself as a leader, as somebody in this who can handle, you know, being walked up to with, you know, notes and, hey, I need you to sign off on this, and there's finances and creative things and, you know, being handed to you at all different times and from all different directions?
No, not really. And, yeah, and all I've really ever wanted to do was to create opportunities to be in the rehearsal hall. And then at a certain point, I felt like that was maybe not enough. And I wanted a relationship with an audience over time.
Right.
And that led to this.
Yeah.
I still most understand the rehearsal hall.
You must have looked forward to Julius Caesar. And just
I thought, always look forward to, like, being
this is,
rehearsal.
This is, yeah, my sweet spot. This is what I really do.
I really love working with actors, and I love the process of decoding and getting underneath a text. I love the process of understanding how conflicting intentions and desire produce drama and produce story. I could do that every day of my life forever. Running a theater company, I'm still feel like I'm new at that, and there's a tremendous amount to learn.
Co-pros,
yeah.
I mean, you've with Groundling on this one, mm-hmm, Obsidian, Theater Francais, on and on it goes. Does that make it tougher when you're directing a show like Julius Caesar? Suddenly you have these other equal voices in the room saying, I don't know about that decision or what have you.
No, not really. I mean, working with people is great and it's hard.
It's democracy.
Yeah.
And, sort of.
And there are always challenges in all forms of collaboration. But as you pointed out, I think my view is that collaboration is always better. You are changed by the people that you work with, and you learn about yourself, and as an organization you learn about yourself through those relationships, and the reality is that collaboration with other organizations, we're all talking to different people, we all have different communities that we're in dialogue with, and I want those communities to meet.
You and I are pretty much neighbors.
Yes.
You live not far from me. Yeah. Remind me, were you a Toronto guy? I'm trying to remember.
I grew up in Montreal originally.
Oh, yeah, that's right, of course.
My parents moved us to Markham when I was a teenager.
Montreal to Markham.
Yeah.
Not a classic move.
Not a classic move, I guess.
I guess GTA, though.
GTA.
I mean, in fairness.
But it was where I grew up was a really, where I spent my teen years was a great place to spend my teen years because it's where I discovered the theater. And I actually started my first theater company there when I was, I think, 13.
Mom and Dad weren't theater people?
They were not at all, no. They were Americans and they were teachers, but they really supported my habit. And a bunch of us are still practicing. A bunch of us are still in the theater or actors. Tracy Michaelides, Salvatore Migliore, Christopher Morris. Many of us have made our way into the profession and stayed there.
Was it a high school thing? Was it?
We had an arts high school in our community, Univille High School, and then I went to the Catholic school. But we had a very vibrant community theater scene, and there was a company that we started that's still around. That is a theater company that has to be run by and operated by, and not necessarily for, but as a testing ground for high school age students. Mm-hmm. And so we all cut our teeth there, and it was a great time.
It is a good time. I grew up in Victoria. Mm-hmm. I went to Claremont, which mm-hmm. ended up getting a guy named Matthew Howe, who mm-hmm. became, he was very well known in the theater community, and he'd done quite mm-hmm. well, and he basically turned it into a theater school. He mm-hmm. Somehow got the funding to build a theater while we were there, and it was all state of the art, and it mm-hmm. was incredible. And then I'm in the Big Brothers program. My little brother goes mm-hmm. to Wexford, so mm-hmm. I've been there a lot over the last couple of years, taking in the Christmas shows and so on and so forth. And it is just, it's a fun time for those mm-hmm. kids mm-hmm. to really get their heads in it.
Yeah, I think
it's magical.
It's magical, not unlike team sports, but I think being a part of something that is bigger than you as an individual, as a teenager, is very powerful.
Yeah. Your kid's going to do this?
I don't know. My daughter's 13 and my son is 7. My daughter flirted a little bit with theater when she was younger, and she's not there anymore. She wants to be, right now, she wants to be a coder.
Right.
And my son is...
That's what, she's smart.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
What the hell are we doing?
Exactly.
God, she's going to be just like waving at us from, her yacht.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is pretty great. And so Markham and theater scene, was it mm-hmm. drama right away, or was it into musical theater and that sort of stuff?
I started out in musical theater.
Of course.
Actually, yeah.
What
because
were the
that's
shows?
Where the first musical I did was West Side Story.
Right.
And had a cast of about, I think, 50 people in it.
Right. It's a lot of talent on stage.
There's a lot of talent on stage. But what I remember from that was just the potency of young people who decide they want to do something together.
Yeah.
I think that really taught me, and taught a lot of us, that if we set our minds to something, we could really actually accomplish some things. That experience from like 13 to 16 or 17 more than anything shaped who I ended up becoming as an adult.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It you found not only a group of peers, but I would imagine you took it as seriously then as you do now.
Absolutely. And this wasn't cheap either. I think West Side Story cost us $40,000.
Holy,
we had to raise
smokes.
All that money.
You did?
Yeah, we bottle drives and bake sales.
Get out and sing in front of people or anything like that?
We did do those kind of
things.
You
got to do those.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's very powerful to sort of self-organize in that way as a group and be able to, put on a show.
What was the next step after that?
I got involved in a co-op program out of my high school at the Graduate Center for Drama at UFT with Colin Taylor and a bunch of other people, and I started to become a little bit involved in the Toronto theater scene just as a kind of an apprentice and an outside eye when I was 17 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me away from the musical theater and towards an undergrad degree at UFT, which didn't last very long. I knew that I wanted to be a director, and I got into the directing program at the National Theatre School. So I left U of T after a year and went to Montreal.
How would you even apply for something like that? You've got this experience with high school. Mm-hmm. You are just getting your feet wet at U of T. Mm-hmm. How do they say, we know that this person has something, there's a spark here?
I don't know how they made that determination. I mean, I had done, for someone my age, I directed quite a few shows at 19. So
there it was. Yeah.
When, you know, in the little micro community that I was in, which was aspiring theater directors, the National Theater School was really the place at that time to look to get training. And it was a well-funded program. And I had a lot of opportunity to develop and to practice while I was there for 2 years.
Was there a show that you think back on, like, that was the one that really helped me to understand where I was going?
Yeah. I did Howard Barker's The Possibilities, an excerpt of, or sort of a portion of that larger piece for my sort of my thesis project. And I had spent 2 years being a student at the National Theater School, being very confused. And it wasn't really until that, my fourth semester, that all of the things that I'd learned really came together for me, and I was able to reconnect to why I wanted to be a director, what my skill set was, and I walked away feeling very, very grateful for my training there.
Confidence level was always pretty solid through this?
I would say that school was the most shaking in some way.
Right.
Probably necessarily so.
Yeah. They got to bring you down a couple notches, right? That's how it works.
Yeah, and also just making conscious all of the things that were maybe not super conscious as a kind of an aspiring director, as a young person. You have to relearn, as you become aware of what it is you're doing, you become self-conscious a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a self-consciousness that I was plagued with in my first year of theater school that I didn't know whether I would actually ever get over.
Right.
And I did.
Yeah, I don't know. That feels like something that just keeps going on, right? You just keep going back to these fundamentals and tweaking nuances of this, that, and the other thing. And if you're an expert in anything, that's sort of an interesting part of the process.
You know? I mean, that's one of, maybe you feel this way, but that's, I think, one of the, if you can get into it, I'm experiencing as one of the pleasures or consolations of getting older is more refined relationship to fixing the things that you're not great at.
Yeah, if you can leave the worry and the dread and the, you know, the sort of sense of I'm just faking this whole thing.
Yeah.
This fraudulent activity that I'm involved in. If you can put that on the
leave it
back
behind
burner
you somehow, yeah.
And actually focus on these little professional tweaks that you can do. It can be wonderful.
I just love it.
Yeah. At some point, you have this sort of spectacular moment in your career. Obviously, it's what Stratford, Shaw, all those things start to happen sort of immediately afterwards, or is there...
No, I spent most of my 20s doing odd jobs at different theaters.
Right.
Around the city. I worked at the bar at Factory Theater for a number of years. Front of house, worked as a publicity assistant at Theatre Passmarais, then spent a couple of years working for Diane Weinrib. You must know Diane.
Of course, yeah.
But just sort of decided that I was going to produce, spend my money kind of producing at the fringe, and started a little company called Go Chicken Go, but be around. And
I just saw Annie Baker's The Flick.
Yeah.
Your wonderful production, which was outstanding, and I loved every second of it, and I love Annie Baker.
Yes.
But that's that world, isn't it? Like you know, get in there and just kind of clean the place up and make sure everything, all the different parts of the machinery are oiled.
Yes.
Part of it.
And it was, I mean, I remember it being very, very exciting. I mean, it was definitely my universe in my 20s was, I just wanted to be a part of the Toronto theater world.
Yeah.
That was like basically the outer edge of the universe as I understood it.
Right.
So I was quite happy to be in all of those spaces with all of these artists that were to me quite legendary. I learned a lot in that time, and I was the beneficiary of a lot of support and guidance from folks like Ken Gass, Lane Coleman, Andy McKim, Urjo Kareda, just to be around those buildings. Bob Baker, like basically every theater in the city, there was a place for me to spend some time and do some kind of job and have some kind of contact with artistic leadership of the organization. So while it was a real slog, I wasn't really getting paid to do what I was doing for a long time. I was super happy.
Did you have to fill in the gaps with the barista gigs and things like this?
I mean, I never really did those kind of jobs because I decided, well, you know, if I want to be in those buildings, I will work front of house, I'll work box office, I'll do the, you know, I didn't do any of the, I just stayed in the theater.
Yeah, my friend Dave LeBlanc, who writes for the Globe and Mail, he does all the architecture stuff for them. He sort of skipped all the real odd times too, just like you.
Yeah.
And I always thought, wow, what would my life have been if I didn't have to, you know, be in the kitchen and be in the, good for you, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I did get to work for Diane Weinrib for about 3 years, writing press releases, and that was
works a certain part of your brain.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Well, basically, you are there to celebrate at all costs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Really. And then that goes on to I don't want to compress time too much, but Stratford and everything you did, the Savinovich Prize, must have been a very exciting time in your life when you actually, you know, sort of progress past these odd jobs in the theater to really start to get some of these opportunities. What was the first?
I think the first big one was probably being asked to direct Kristen Thompson's I, Claudia at the Tarragon. Was, I don't know if it was the first, it might have been the first play that I was paid to direct.
Wow. The same room that they're in now, or?
It was in the studio.
Okay.
And it was with, so my current wife was roommates with Kristen Thompson at the time. And it was Kristen's first play, and she said, you know, would you like to direct? And I said, yes, absolutely. And so that was a hugely exciting moment, being in a theater that I had, you know, I used to come down from Markham every weekend for the Sunday pay weekends. And that place was very, very high on my list of if I could make it to the Tarragon, that would be, you know, I could die. Yeah, I was very, very excited about that. And then from there, I think I slowly but surely, although the idea that there's to have a career as a director, I mean, most of my quote-unquote professional life, it seemed impossible.
Right.
But then at a certain point, I guess I got established and I started to get enough opportunities that I was surprised that I was able to make a living at being a director.
Right.
And then I was, and I still am. I'm very, very grateful for that.
Well, like, I'm not sure where I heard this or if it was just you and I talking in passing, but I know your wife is very active and she's very passionate about
the environment
and so on and so forth. And community is very, very important to you. Mm. We've touched on it a little bit, but it feels like all of that awareness and engagement has a lot to do with what you've tried to do with Crows too. It's all sort of part and parcel. It's all part of the same sort of energy and movement of let's get people together. Let's see what we can do to move the needle a little.
It's funny. My dad passed away this fall.
Yeah.
And thanks. And
not easy.
And he had been a priest in the early part of his life, and then he went on to become a high school teacher, and was very active in sort of different kinds of social justice circles. And I grew up in a household where making a difference in the world was a kind of a big deal for him.
Right. And expectation.
I don't know that it was expectation, but he went through all sorts of different phases in his life, but it really mattered to him that you try as best you can to move the needle somehow. And community and other people and the capacity of other people to do powerful things, he really believed in that. And I think
it's quite an installation into
Yeah.
Someone like yourself to have somebody. Who
yeah, I mean, I always looked up to that part of my dad, and he did have a sense of mission in his quiet way, which he continued into his retirement. I'm sure that that has had some deep impact on how I think about an artist's role. And yeah, I still really believe in art and in the theater. I think the theater is more important than ever.
Yeah.
There were periods of my life where I really questioned the power of theater to theater's place in the world in the face of other forms of communication and storytelling. But with the advent of, you know, these kind of devices that we're sitting next to right now, and the presence of screens in our lives, and the amount of information, the experience that I described to you of sitting in a room with other people for a couple of hours around, you know, sometimes ancient stories, I just think is such an important experience. And I've also had kids now, and so I see the different kinds of relationships that they have to storytelling when they're in the theater versus going to the cinema or sitting in front of a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned to really value, even as I'm, you know, don't understand exactly why all the time, there's something irreplaceable about the art form that I practice. And so it helps me feel really good about what it is we're here doing.
I believe that, even in my moments of dread and my disappointment with the whole, you know, the whole process and everything that's happening around us right now, I truly do believe that there is something wonderful about it and something to be gleaned if done properly.
Yeah.
And what else can we do?
Exactly.
Aside from that. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much.
This is a long time coming.
Yeah, an unexpected set of questions. I really enjoyed the interview. Thank you.
There goes Chris. Really a pleasure to get a chance to sit down with him. I love talking to him and just thinking big and not afraid to say what's on his mind, and a guy who really has applied himself in the arts. And we're the benefactors here in Toronto. CrowsTheatre.com for tickets to Julius Caesar. By the way, it runs through the 2nd. That's it. Don't forget, you can listen to episodes of Art at the End of the World at classicalfm.ca and artattheendoftheworld.com. And everywhere you enjoy listening to podcasts, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, everywhere. Tune in. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Red Eye Media and, of course, Crow's Theater. And thanks to you. Thanks for checking out the show. We have an Art at the End of the World Facebook page. The Twitter handle is @ArtAtTheEnd. You can find my Instagram handle @WigDad. Not Wigmore, WigDad. I'm back on Thursday on Art at the End of the World with a remix episode, maybe our pre-Oscars episode, I suppose, with the co-head of the Toronto International Film Festival, Cameron Bailey. And if you happen to hear the original episode last year, we're adding a bunch more to it because we've had conversations with Cameron since. So it really will be a remix episode on Thursday. Don't forget, you can hear my program, The Oasis, on the new Classical FM weekdays, 3 to 7 Eastern, 12 to 4 Pacific, at classicalfm.ca, and you can watch the broadcast live on YouTube if you prefer, and of course just on the FM radio, Toronto at 96.3, Cobourg at 103.1, and Collingwood at 102.9. We're back on Thursday. Speak to you then, and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.